If you find yourself stranded in a place that's not Earth, then you've somehow managed to escape not just the clutches of our lonely planet, but also the scope of this book. Good luck. If you're not reading this on the solstice or equinox dates mentioned here, you can approximate the adjustments required to account for Earth's current axial tilt by adding the result of the following equation to your measurement. The adjustment is negative t times the cosine of all of 360 degrees divided by 365 times open bracket d plus 10 close bracket. The d there represents the day of the year you get when you count January 1st as 0, January 2nd as 1, and so on. The 10 is added to it to get the number of days since the December solstice. Similarly, T represents Earth's current axial tilt in degrees, and you can see section 10.7.1 for a way to measure your Earth's axial tilt. And with that, finally, latitude is a solved problem. Now, all you have to do is calculate longitude, and that's way simpler. Longitude is a measurement of how far east or west you are of your prime meridian. Since you already know the Earth rotates west to east a full 360 degrees each day, which you do because we just told you, it's clear that 1 degree of longitude corresponds to 1/360th of a day, or 4 minutes. Footnote, this assumes a 24-hour day. Your days may well be shorter. That's because the moon's gravity causes tides, but these tides cause a small amount of friction between the Earth and its oceans, which acts as a tiny break. This makes Earth's rotation slower in the future and faster in the past. You can expect a day that's about 17.8 seconds shorter for every million years you go back in time. End footnote. Your longitude is the difference between noon where you are and noon where your prime meridian is. Footnote, here we're using actual solar noons, when the sun is at its peak in the sky, and not any approximations of noon that you might have invented when you came up with time zones. See section 10.7.1, clocks. End footnote. For example, if your noon happens 8 minutes before the noon at the prime meridian, you know you're 2 degrees of longitude to the east of that line. Similarly, if your noon is 20 minutes after the prime meridian's noon, your longitude must be 5 degrees to the west. Longitude is trivial, assuming you believe that keeping track of what time it is at the prime meridian isn't the sort of thing that will stymie humanity for thousands of years. This is the point where we regret to inform you that keeping track of what time it is at the prime meridian absolutely is the sort of thing that will stymie humanity for thousands of years. The reason is simple. Clocks typically rely on some repeating movement, a pendulum swinging, water dripping, balls rolling, whatever, which are motions that work great on land, but completely fall apart on boats. One strong wave can knock a pendulum out of whack, and that's not even factoring in the endless sway of the boat. To combat this, boats would sometimes carry dozens of clocks, each drifting slightly out of sync in a different way, under the hope that the average of all these times would be accurate. But this wasn't a solution, and ships kept getting lost and sinking. Footnote, the HMS Beagle had 22 different chronometers on board when it set out in 1831 CE for the trip on which Charles Darwin would begin to formulate his theory of evolution. They were all stored in a single specialized cabin at the bottom of the ship where movement would be minimized, and no one was allowed to enter the room except to tend to the clocks. 5 years later, the ship returned with only 11 of those 22 clocks still in working order, but it did return. End footnote. It was such a problem that as early as 1567 CE, various governments began offering cash prizes for any solution that would enable longitude to be determined at sea. By 1707 CE, the British were willing to give up to £20,000 to anyone with a workable solution, the equivalent to a multi-million dollar prize today. If you're around during these times, great news, you're about to be rich. In unaltered history, the solution is about what you'd expect. Brilliant clockmakers dedicated their entire lives to the problem and eventually came up with some incredibly clever, incredibly expensive, incredibly complicated marine chronometers. Chronometers that you're not going to build because they're really, really difficult. Instead, you're going to think outside the box, and you're going to leapfrog to the solution still used in the modern era. You're going to send time through the air itself on invisible waves of energy that travel at the speed of light. You're going to invent radio. and you're going to save the lives of millions of sailors who haven't yet been born. End note. This suggestion that the early invention of radio could have saved a lot of time messing around trying to invent clocks that work on boats has been put forward before. I encountered it in Lewis Dartnell's The Knowledge. End note. Sidebar. How far is it between lines of latitude and longitude anyway? The distance 1 degree latitude and longitude cover on an Earth-shaped planet, and here we are giving exact oblate spheroid numbers because we care, are given below for different latitudes. The distances between longitudes drop to 0 kilometers at 90 degrees of latitude because then you're at the poles, and that's where all your longitude lines converge to a point. At latitude 0, the distance between lines of latitude is 110.574 kilometers. The distance between lines of longitude is 111.320 kilometers. At plus or minus 15 degrees of latitude, the distance between lines of latitude is 110.649 kilometers, and between lines of longitude is 107.551 kilometers. At plus or minus 30 degrees, the distance between lines of latitude is 110.852 kilometers, and between lines of longitude is 96.486 kilometers. At plus or minus 45 degrees, the distance between lines of latitude is 111.132 kilometers, and between lines of longitude is 78.847 kilometers. At plus or minus 60 degrees, the distance between lines of latitude is 111.412 kilometers, and between lines of longitude is 55.800 kilometers. At plus or minus 75 degrees, the distance between lines of latitude is 111.618 kilometers, and between lines of longitude is 28.902 kilometers. And finally, at plus or minus 90 degrees, the distance between lines of latitude is 111.694 kilometers, and between lines of longitude is 0 kilometers. This was Table 15, labeled A Chart of Numbers That Will Seem Pretty Boring Until You're on a Boat in the Middle of the Ocean and Want to Know How Much Farther Away Land Is, and then you'll be like, I'm glad I read this chart. It turns out it wasn't boring after all, and I truly apologize for all my past sass. 10.12.4. Radio. The coming of the wireless era will make war impossible, because it will make war ridiculous. You. Also, Guglielmo Marconi. What it is? A way to transmit ideas and information at almost the speed of light, lessening the barriers of time and distance that have held humanity in their grasp since time immemorial. So that's cool. Before it was invented, if you wanted to listen to music, you had to leave your house and physically go to a concert. And who has the motivation to do that? Originally invented. 1864 CE, electromagnetic waves predicted. 1874 CE, for the first cat's whisker radio detector. 1880 CE for the first intentional radio transmission, 1895 CE for radio signals sent and received over a distance of 2.4 kilometers, and 1901 CE for radio signals sent and received across the Atlantic Ocean, a distance of 3,500 kilometers. Prerequisites: electricity for transmission, metal for wires, and magnets for speakers. How to invent? You've probably heard of the electromagnetic or EM spectrum. It describes a range of radiation, which is just energy moving through space, that includes everything from radio to visible light to X-rays. Here's a map of it. Here we have figure 40, the electromagnetic spectrum. It shows a list of radiation types and their wavelength in meters. Gamma rays are the most energetic, with a wavelength of around 10 to the negative 12 meters. Then you've got X-rays, ultraviolet light, visible light, infrared light, microwaves, and radio waves. Radio waves have a wavelength of 10 meters or longer. There are gamma rays at the high energy end, low energy radio waves at the other end, and a tiny sliver of visible light near the middle. Footnote, when we say tiny sliver, we're not fooling. Visible light has wavelengths ranging from 400 to 700 nanometers, which means everything you've seen and everything you ever will see reaches your eyes via a mere 300 nanometers of spectrum. End footnote. You're probably most familiar with the visible light part of the spectrum, since you're absorbing that radiation with your eyes to read these words. Or at least, I am. Hello. We've divided visible light up into colors. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet, but the only thing that separates them from one another is their energy levels. Footnote, those aren't the only ways to do it. Since color is a spectrum, you can assign however many labels you want to whatever colors you choose. For example, while English speakers say that blue and green are different colors, Chinese has a color that includes them both. In the opposite direction, what an English speaker calls red might be identified by multiple names in Hungarian, Turkish, Irish, and Scottish Gaelic. And even this is an approximation. Anyone who works with color will identify shades that the average person wouldn't care to distinguish. An interior decorator, don't worry, you'll have them again someday, can pick out crimson, burgundy, carmine, amaranth, maroon, folly, oxblood, redwood, rosewood, vermilion, coquelicot, carnelian, auburn, rose, and wine out of a lineup, while the rest of us see only shades of red. End footnote. Our brains transform certain levels of visible light radiation into what we perceive as yellow, while others might be turned into purple, but all colors and all EM radiation are fundamentally the same kind of thing. Electromagnetic radiation at different energy levels, all traveling at the speed of light. Some levels of EM radiation pass right through our bodies with minimal interference, like radio waves, while others slam right into them, like light. Intuitively, visible light probably seems different from radio, but there's actually nothing particularly special about it, except it's at a frequency that happens to get absorbed by our bodies, which is actually one of the reasons humans evolved to see it. Footnote, we couldn't see radio waves if we wanted to. They already travel right through our eyes without hitting them. But there are some animals that can see slightly outside our visual range. Mantis shrimp can see all the colors we can, plus a bit into the infrared and ultraviolet spectrum. They have access to colors humans haven't even dreamed of, mainly because it's very difficult for humans to imagine colors they haven't already seen. This leads us to an open question in philosophy, the thought experiment of Mary the Super Scientist, first proposed in 1982 CE by one Frank Jackson. In it, you have a woman, the eponymous Mary, who is a brilliant scientist born with a disease that lets her see only in black and white. Incredibly, she spent her entire life in a black and white room with a black and white computer hooked up to the internet. But despite these limitations, Mary has thrived. She's learned each and every piece of physical information there is to know about how color works, how light interacts with the eye, what that information does in the brain, everything. She is the world's expert on color and the human body, all from inside her black and white room. Then, one day, Mary's disease is cured, and she's let out of her room. She steps outside and looks up to the beautiful blue sky for the very first time in her life. And the question for you is, does she learn anything new? In other words, is there knowledge that can't be taught and which can only be obtained from direct conscious experience? Don't ask us for the answer. We just build the time machines. End footnote. And while it's true that we can't see other parts of the EM spectrum besides light, we can still sense some of them. Radiation with slightly lower energy than red, the lowest energy color we can see, is called infrared radiation, and we can sense that as heat with our skin. Radiation slightly more energetic than violet is called ultraviolet, and we can sense that with our skin too, via what is technically called a potentially fatal radiation burn. Footnote, that's what a sunburn is. It's not the sunlight you see or the infrared heat you feel that burns you, but rather the high-energy ultraviolet radiation that's penetrating your skin, damaging your DNA, and causing that radiation burn. Anytime you damage a cell's DNA, you risk that cell becoming cancerous, hence the potential fatality mentioned above. End footnote. So now that you're familiar with the basics of EM radiation, let's talk radio, which is simply the technology of using EM waves to carry information. In the modern era, this is done in several ways. Modulating the radio signal's amplitude, which is how high the radio waves go up and down, gives us AM radio, short for amplitude modulation. Modulating its frequency, how often those waves go up and down, gives us FM. The strategy here is to encode information in how much the amplitude or frequency changes, but that's more advanced than what you need. You'll get there, but for your immediate purposes, you just want to be able to send a radio signal. You'll be generating radio waves the easy way, which also happens to be the most impressive mad scientist way too, by creating artificial lightning, also known as electricity. When electricity travels through the air, this is called arcing, and you can learn more about that in section 10.10.3, it produces all sorts of EM radiation. There's light, which is what makes lightning look so cool, but also a bunch of radio radiation. If you can produce arcing at will, and by cutting a wire so that the only way for electricity to travel is by arcing between those two pieces, you can, then you can generate radio signals, and the strength of your transmission is limited only by the amount of power you can get to arc. If you're conveying information simply by the existence of a radio burst, for example, a transmission at noon for timekeeping, see section 10.12.3, then you're done. But if you add a switch so you can turn it off and on in patterns, you can broadcast any information you want in Morse code. Footnote, if you don't know Morse code, don't worry. Just make it up and name it after yourself instead. The idea behind Morse code is to represent each letter by a different series of dashes, which are long transmissions, and dots, which are short transmissions, with a short silence between each letter. If you want to get fancy, give the most common letters shorter representations and less common letters longer ones, and your code will be able to transmit information more efficiently. Which letters are the most common? We have conveniently provided you with an entire text with over 600,000 letters in it in the form of this book. So all you need to do is tally up each of those letters to see which ones are the most popular. This is left as a fun exercise for the reader. End footnote. Morse code is the same technology used in the wire telegraph, which you can also invent now if you want, just by having your switch connect by wire to a distant buzzer instead of to an electric arc radio transmitter. Wire telegraphy may be simpler for overland transmission, but you'll want to use wireless for transoceanic transmissions, at least until you reach the point of laying cable at the bottom of the sea. To pick up these signals, you're going to build the world's first radio signal detector, and you won't even need batteries. The radio signals themselves will power it. First, you'll need an antenna. Any long wire will work, but 30 meters or more is ideal. Put one end in the ground and the other end someplace high, a tree on land or the top of your mast on a boat. Footnote, and if you are on a boat, a wire trailing into the water will function as a simple ground, but a metal plate on the underside of your boat provides a ground with more surface area and therefore more effectiveness. End footnote. Radio waves, which, remember, are just electromagnetic radiation, will interact with this long wire and induce electrons to move up and down in it, creating current. To detect this energy, you're going to invent the diode. A diode is a device that lets electrical current flow in only one direction. Diodes are an example of semiconductors, materials that conduct current differently under different circumstances. In our modern era, our semiconductors have evolved from vacuum tubes to transistors to integrated circuits, but you don't need any of that. All you need are some plain old rocks. Natural semiconducting rocks include galena, one of the most common lead ores, a dark and shiny angular rock often found with calcite, and iron pyrite, aka fool's gold, easy to spot because it's so shiny. You only need a tiny bit. One crystal of these rocks will do. You may remember stories about your ancestors building toy crystal radios back when they were young and radio was new. You're building the same thing here. Once you've got your crystal diode, securely connect your antenna to it while still leaving it grounded, and make a second, very gentle contact to your crystal with a thin wire, historically called a cat's whisker. Footnote, so named because any thin wire looks a little bit like a cat's whisker if you squint sufficiently hard enough. End footnote. You'll probably have to experiment with your cat's whisker touching different positions on your crystal until you find one that's the most semiconductive. When you find it, your whisker will carry electricity when your antenna picks up a radio signal. A small amount, to be sure, but enough to indicate that a radio transmission has been received. Endnote. Like many inventions, radio receivers were independently invented by multiple people at around the same time. In this case, two men, Edwin H. Armstrong and Lee DeForest, fought for years over patent rights to their inventions. As in many cases in the early days of any technology, these people knew that their inventions worked, but they were sometimes completely misinformed as to why that was the case. In the early days of radio broadcasting, George H. Douglas writes that, quote, "At almost every step of the way, DeForest was flat out wrong about what he was inventing. His radio receiver was not so much an invention as it was the steady, persistent accumulation of error." End quote. Ouch. End note. To make that electricity audible, you're going to create a solenoid, which is just a wire tightly wrapped into a coil. When electricity runs through a wire, it creates a magnetic field, and by coiling that wire around itself, that field is intensified. As you saw in section 10.6.2, that's an electromagnet. Put a regular magnet inside that coil, and it'll move inside your solenoid at the same rate the electricity does. Attach that magnet to a lightweight but sturdy cone so that air gets moved as the magnet does, and you've converted changes in electricity into movement of air. In other words, you've just invented the world's first speaker. Here we have figure 41, which shows what was just described. An electromagnet with a magnet inside it attached to a paper cone. The cone produces noise as the magnet moves, induced by the charge in the electromagnet. It's labeled figure 41, the world's first speaker, make some noise. The relatively low level of electricity here means it'll be a quiet speaker, more suited as a small headphone set than as something to get the party people moving with some block-rocking beats, but the same principle applies to both. Some caveats. Radio transmission works better at night than during the day because the Earth's upper atmosphere, called the ionosphere, is electrically charged by the sun. When radio waves travel through the lower ionosphere during the day, they interact with the solar-charged ions there and degrade. But the layer becomes transparent to radio waves at night, which is great, and the layer of the ionosphere above it actually reflects radio waves that arrive at an oblique enough angle, which is even better. Bouncing signals off the ionosphere at night is a completely reasonable way to send information across huge distances. In fact, when you're transmitting at distances far enough that the curvature of the Earth means there's no straight line between sender and receiver that doesn't travel through solid radio-blocking rock, it may be the only way. Footnote, while radio waves do travel through most things, the thicker and denser the material, the more the signal decays. End footnote. You should also keep in mind that electromagnetic radiation doesn't travel forever at the same strength. The intensity of any broadcast radiation, whether electromagnetic, gravitational, or sound waves, is actually inversely proportional to the square of the distance between you and it. In other words, the more you move away, the faster the signal seems to decay. Even we, who can bend the very chronotons to our will, can't change this inverse square law, but it can be mitigated by broadcasting at a higher intensity. The first transatlantic transmission, organized by the very Marconi whose quotation, gracing this section, was sadly not as predictive as he had hoped, was achieved with a spark gap transmitter of the type described here, only with a lot of power behind it and a really large receiving antenna waiting for it on the other side of the ocean. 10.12.5. Boats. One cannot discover new lands without consenting to lose sight, for a very long time, of the shore. You. Also, André Gide. What they are. A way to open up the 70% or so of the world's surface that's covered in water to exploration, fishing, trade, and cool parties in international waters. Footnote. This statistic holds true for just about any time period you can survive in. The amount of the Earth's surface covered in water has been approximately 70% since the formation of the supercontinent Pangaea around 300,000 BCE, because the continents since then have stayed about the same size and just sort of slowly drifted around. All the water on Earth has to go somewhere, and the only places to store it are either A, on the surface in big liquid piles, which we call oceans and lakes, B, in the atmosphere as clouds, but the atmosphere can only get so hydrated, and C, as ice at the poles. Polar ice caps can famously grow and shrink, which raises and lowers sea levels and thereby exposes or covers land. But even fully melted, polar ice can change sea levels only so much, 70 meters when fully melted, to be precise, which results in only about 3% less land. It's a very important 3%, however, given how many human settlements are on the coastlines. End footnote. Before they were invented, humans were unable to expand anywhere they couldn't walk, crawl, or swim, which left everything from tiny islands to entire continents completely uncolonized. Instead, folks just stared out at the sea and sighed. Originally invented, 900,000 BCE. This is when proto-humans travel over 18 kilometers of water to reach the Flores Island in Indonesia. 130,000 BCE, which is when humans travel over water from the Greek mainland to Crete. 46,000 BCE is when humans travel over water to Australia. 7,000 BCE is the invention of reed boats. 55,000 BCE for sailboats. 100 CE for sailing into the wind. 1783 CE for steam-powered boats. And 1836 CE for propeller-based boats. Prerequisites: wood for dugouts, rope, tar for boats made of reed or logs, metalworking and welding for pintles and gudgeons, textiles for sailboats, compasses, preserved foods, latitude and longitude for the kick-ass boats you're going to want to invent once you see how kick-ass they are, and spinning wheels for the fishing nets you'll want in order to invent offshore fishing, which you'll want to do because there's some really tasty fish offshore. How to invent. The earliest boats, called dugouts, were incredibly simple. Hollow out a big enough tree trunk to sit in, and my friend, you have invented boats. You can create better, larger boats by taking reeds, logs, or planks, strapping them together with rope or nails into a boat-shaped hull, which is pointy at the front and square at the back, and waterproofing them by cramming plant matter between the cracks before sealing them with tar or pitch. See section 10.1.1, charcoal. If that feels too ambitious, you can just build a raft. But rafts are better suited to drifting than going somewhere in particular. It's the shaped hull of boats that lets them slice through water in a directed way. Remember, boats go where you want, rafts go where they want. You want boats. Steering a boat is easily done with a rudder, which took humans, and this should not be anything close to a surprise at this point, a long time to figure out. Before their invention, one or more large steering oars were hung off one side of the boat, which was the state of the art until rudders were invented in China around 100 CE. The idea finally arrived in Europe 1,000 years later, around 1100 CE. Europeans, pull up your socks. Rudders, see section 10.12.6, can be attached to the back of your boats using pintles and gudgeons, which are adorable names for a very simple invention. A gudgeon is a tube, and a pintle is the corresponding bolt that fits perfectly inside that tube, which allows whatever is attached to rotate freely, exactly like you'd want a rudder to do. These weren't invented until the 1400 CE, so the technology in your boat has already advanced several millennia in just a few paragraphs, and we're just getting started. Here we have figure 42, a pintle and gudgeon. It shows, as described, a tube with a correspondingly smaller bolt that fits inside, and openings to attach a rudder to it. To avoid having to physically push your boat through the water by paddling like some kind of primo chump, you'll want to invent either sails or engines. Engines are discussed elsewhere, section 10.5.4, so let's focus on sails, which make for a much more gorgeous boat anyway. Throw up a square sheet, held upright and loose enough that it can fill with air, set it perpendicular to the length of your boat so it catches the wind, and hey presto, your boat will move through the water, and you've invented sailing, Captain. You can sail wherever there's wind that's moving faster than the water is. Footnote: if the wind is traveling slower than the water is, then you're not sailing, you're drifting, and you're going to keep drifting until the wind picks up again. Sailors call this being becalmed, but it's not particularly calming when you're becalmed in the ocean, miles away from shore, running out of food and fresh water and baking in the sun. Sailors should instead call it be calm, but also be aware this could actually be a big problem. End footnote. But this is entry-level sailing, the kind that's been invented multiple times throughout history, and it won't let you travel in a direction more than 60 degrees off from the wind's direction. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to sail in any direction you like? Wouldn't it be nice to be so powerful as to be able to sail directly into the wind, making the very forces of nature subservient to your will, and thereby conquering the sea itself? It would. So let's invent that now. Instead of a square sail mounted perpendicular to the line of your boat, build a triangular sail that runs along its length instead. Footnote: it's not actually an either-or proposition between sail types. Many boats, especially larger ones, Combine square sails with fore-aft rigging, using them in different situations. Square sails still work best when the wind is blowing directly behind you. End footnote. These triangular sails are called fore-aft sails because they run from the back, in sailor talk, the aft, to the front, sailor talk, fore, of your boat, sailor talk, a fine sloop, yarr. By mounting this sail on a boom, which is a large rotating beam attached to the mast, you can rotate your sail, allowing your boat, and the sail driving it, to be at different angles. Use rope to tie your boom where you want it to stay, between adjustments. This greater sail control allows you to harness the wind from almost any angle, up to about 45 degrees into the wind. And even though you can't sail in a straight line directly into the wind, you can approximate it by sailing 45 degrees off from the wind's angle, and then switching direction every once in a while to the opposite 45-degree angle. This is called tacking, and it produces a zigzag motion. And yes, while it is less efficient than going in a straight line, and yes, while it does require you to adjust your sails regularly, who cares? You're sailing into the wind, while every other civilization on the planet is probably still messing around with hauling out a tree and calling themselves Johnny Boats a lot. And here we have figure 43, square and fore aft rigging. It shows two boats, one with a square sail in the center of the boat, pushing with wind directly behind it, and the other has a triangular fore aft sail that can be adjusted by the boom to any angle desired. But that's not the only thing wind does to this new triangular sail. When you position it obliquely, just slightly into the wind, so that your sail is only a few degrees off from parallel to the wind's direction, some wind fills your sail, but the rest passes over it on the other side. This makes the sail act like a wing, just like it does on an airplane in section 10.12.6, human flight, and this creates lift. With lift, wind is not just pushing your sails, but pulling them in the same direction from the other side. Combining pushing and pulling allows sailboats to actually sail faster than the wind itself. A skilled sailor with a proper boat can achieve a travel speed of 1.5 times the wind. Something to shoot for. Here's figure 44, which shows tacking and the points of sail on a boat. Tacking shows a boat sailing into the wind, taking 45-degree cuts every once in a while, while sail positions and directions of travel illustrate the positions sails must be in to achieve different directions of travel. If you're sailing with the wind, your sail is almost perpendicular to the direction the boat is traveling in, which is adjusted to sail at other angles as well. The power of wind you're now harnessing will make your boats want to tip over, so store your heavy things in the bottom of your boat as a stabilizing ballast, and install a keel, which is a long vertical board shaped like a shark fin, on the underside of your boat, right along its center line. You can put a keel at both the front and back of your boat, or just one in its middle. Keels act as a counterforce on the wind to help prevent your boat from capsizing, and have the added benefit of making your ship move forward in the wind rather than slipping sideways. If you do decide to add engines to your boat, you'll want water propellers. Footnote: the earliest steam-powered boats didn't have any propellers. They used large paddle wheels instead, but the propeller is a more efficient use of force. Paddle wheels sure are pretty, though. They're also more difficult to jam, so if you want a pretty and less jamming alternative to propellers, try paddle wheels. End footnote. Propeller is just a machine that turns rotational motion into thrust. And while humans technically invented them relatively early on, it still took us almost 2,000 years to realize what we come up with. The earliest origins of the propeller go back, forward to you probably, to the Archimedes screw, first invented in Assyria around 650 BCE, but named after Archimedes, who popularized it to Europeans around 300 BCE. The Archimedes screw is simply a big long screw stuck in an open-ended tube, and then the whole business is put at an angle with one end submerged. Rotating the screw in the right direction causes water to be lifted up through the tube, which can be really useful if you want to irrigate your crops. Footnote: the space between the screw and the tube doesn't even have to be flush. It just has to be tight enough that the water you raise is greater than the water you lose from it leaking down again. This is great news for any civilization that hasn't invented precision engineering yet, which probably includes yours. End footnote. Archimedes screws were used this way for thousands of years, but it still took until 1836 for someone to think of cutting one off and putting it in the water. There, thanks to the every action has an equal and opposite reaction law, these propellers didn't just move water, they also move, in the opposite direction, any vessel they are attached to. Footnote. Remember, you discovered these laws in section 10.5.3, down at the bottom of the page in a footnote, just like this one. End footnote. That's really all the first propeller was, a mini Archimedes screw long enough to contain two rotations. By accident, this propeller broke in half during early testing, and that was how humans discovered that a broken, single-rotation propeller was twice as efficient as a two-rotation propeller it used to be. The bladed propellers you're familiar with are, in effect, multiple screws working in parallel. Feel free to skip ahead to that final propeller design. It's the best one. And here we have figure 45, an Archimedes screw and its descendants, single screw and modern propellers. The Archimedes screw is as described, a long, twisting coil in a tube bringing water up with each rotation. The two-rotation screw propeller takes two loops of the Archimedes screw and attaches that to a drive. The single screw propeller is half of that two-rotation screw propeller, and the modern propeller has four blades, each a section of that larger, historical Archimedes screw. 10.12.6. Human flight. Aeronautics was neither an industry nor a science. It was a miracle. You. Also, Igor Sikorsky. What it is, a way to fulfill the earliest dream of humanity, held in perpetuity ever since our gaze first alighted upon the majestic beauty of a bird in flight, and thought, oh, hey, that looks cool, I want to do that now. Before it was invented, you were born on the ground, and you died on the ground, and you told yourself this was fine, and you were silly to ever dream of anything greater. Originally invented, 500 BCE for strapping humans to giant kites, 1250 CE for the earliest sketches for lighter-than-air flight designed to be powered by technology not yet discovered, 1716 CE for the earliest published sketches for heavier-than-air flight designed to be powered by technology, again, not yet discovered, 1783 CE for the first lighter-than-air flight, 1874 CE for the first externally powered heavier-than-air flight, and 1902 CE for the first self-powered heavier-than-air flight. Prerequisites. Paper and fabric, or if you have it, silk. Sulfuric acid and iron for hydrogen airships. Wood for gliders and heavier-than-air flight. Engines and metal for powered heavier-than-air flight. Compasses and latitude and longitude for navigation. How to invent. A hot air balloon is an astonishingly simple invention. Fire creates hot air, which rises. If you put a fabric bag above that hot air, it'll fill with it, and a big enough bag, with small enough leaks, will become buoyant enough to rise through the air. Hold on to a large enough bag, or, to save your arms from getting tired, attach a basket to the bottom that you climb into, and you will rise with it. You don't even need to seal the bag at the bottom, since the hottest air rises to the top, and the air at the bottom will be at about the same temperature and pressure as the surrounding atmosphere. You can keep it tethered to the ground for early test flights, add sand for ballast, which you can toss overboard to lighten your weight as you sink, which is useful for slowing your descent as the hot air in the bag escapes or cools, and eventually, you can even bring the fire on board, which, while more dangerous, lets you increase your altitude during flight. In other words, it turns out that to invent human flight, the dream of thousands and thousands of generations of humanity, you only need some fabric and some fire. That's it. And it still took us until 1783 CE to figure it out. We have made a lot of hay in this text out of how long it takes humans to invent something even after they've got all the prerequisite technologies, but this is gosh darn humiliating. If you draw a line between when humans had the technological prerequisites, fire and the drop spindle needed for fabric creation, and the time when they finally took flight for the first time, that line covers almost 10,000 years. Hot air balloons aren't like space flight or time travel, technologies that require many members of a civilization to work together to produce them. The original hot air balloons were invented by two bored brothers out of a burlap sack. With enough motivation, you don't even need a civilization to produce a hot air balloon. A single individual, even in Neolithic times and without any spindles or spinning wheels, could, over the course of their life, collect enough plant and animal fibers and spin enough thread by hand to create a hot air balloon. In the more than 200,000 years during which this was possible, nobody ever thought to do that. Instead, flight-minded humans usually just looked at birds and tried to copy them, which typically involved making giant feather-covered artificial wings and sometimes covering the person strapped to the wings in feathers too, just to be safe. Civilization pro tip: covering yourself in feathers is neither a necessary nor sufficient condition for flight, but rather is a choice that should be made for fashion purposes only. Since taking off from land in such a contraption wouldn't work, people instead jumped from towers wearing them, assuming that was the secret to flight. At best, they could hope to glide for a short distance, but these pilots usually fell straight down to either broken bones, death, or castration. As with most things involving heights, a lot depends on what you fall on and how hard you fall on it. The lack of flight was sometimes blamed on pilots not having a tail, 852 CE and in 1010 CE, on them using chicken feathers instead of eagle feathers, 1507 CE, or on the wind not being strong enough to fill out their coat like a sail to help keep them airborne, 1589 CE. Footnote: yep, this was the one that resulted in castration. A near contemporary account of this can be found in a publication made by one John Hackett in 1692 CE, delightfully titled Scrinia Resurretta, a memorial offered to the great deservings of John Williams, D.D., who sometime held the places of Lord Keeper of the Great Seal of England, Lord Bishop of Lincoln, and Lord Archbishop of York, containing a series of the most remarkable occurrences and transactions of his life in relation both to church and state, part 4. And footnote. Endnote: the publication referenced was actually published under that title and survives into the present day. And endnote. In China, around 500 BCE, kites were invented, and you can invent them too, just spread fabric across a light framework, attach a string, and add a tail for stability. Afterwards, sufficiently large kites in strong enough winds were being used to lift humans, but anyone who has flown a kite and seen how easily they can crash knows how dangerous and deadly this was. Around 200 BCE, the Chinese had also invented paper sky lanterns, which are in effect tiny hot air balloons powered by a candle. However, despite this, nobody ever scaled this idea up to human-sized flight. In contrast, in 2050 CE, a European actually published a book with a design for a hot air balloon in it, but since nobody at the time had figured out that air had weight and hot air weighed less, it was designed to be filled with ethereal air, a gas, to be invented in the future, that was capable of floating in the atmosphere. Footnote: it wasn't quite a modern hot air balloon, but all the parts were there. The design, by Franciscan friar Roger Bacon, featured a single-mast sailboat held aloft by four large balloons, which were hollow copper globes, attached to the hull of the boat with rope. Remove the mast, and you've got the equivalent of a modern invention, a basket held aloft by balloons. End footnote. Put simply, in 200 BCE, humanity held in one hand the knowledge that hot air rose, and by 1250 CE, held in the other hand a design for a machine that could be powered by hot air, but the two ideas were never joined together until both were rediscovered in France in 1783 CE. And these Frenchmen, the Montgolfier brothers, who named their hot air balloon the Montgolfier, a name still used by the French today, didn't even know that hot air rose. Their earliest experiments were, as we said, done with a burlap sack lined with paper to help keep the air in. They initially used steam as fuel, but this tended to ruin the paper, so they instead switched to wood smoke, believing it to be some kind of electric steam that released a special gas they named Montgolfier gas, because of course they did, and this gas had a special property for them called levity. Even with all these fundamental misunderstandings of what was going on, the basic idea of capture a lighter-than-air gas in a thing, and then the thing goes up, was all that was required for that first flight. The finer and tighter the weave of your fabric, the better it will hold air, and silk, section 10.8.4, works great. The direction a hot air balloon travels in is, of course, up to the winds, but by adding engines to your balloon, you'll get directional control, and with that, you've invented the airship. But can you do even better? You absolutely can. While the hot air you've been using rises because it's lighter than regular air, it's far from the lightest gas there is. And you want lighter gases, because the lighter the gas, the less fuel you need to get airborne, the more you can lift, and the farther you can travel. An obvious improvement here would be to eschew heated air entirely and fill your balloons with the lightest gas in the entire universe instead. So let's do that. The lightest gas in the entire universe is hydrogen, and Appendix C.11 shows how you can use electricity to extract it from brine. But if you need a lot of it, and you will if you're building airships, you'll probably want to use cheaper methods. You could run steam over a red-hot iron, which will break up the steam into hydrogen as a gas, and oxygen, which will helpfully form iron oxide on the iron, but this requires a lot of iron. An easier solution is to do as early amateur aviators did in our timeline, and rely on the fact that dilute sulfuric acid reacts with iron to produce hydrogen gas. Footnote, sulfuric acid actually reacts with lots of metals, including aluminum, zinc, manganese, magnesium, and nickel, but you'll probably use iron since that's likely to be the easiest metal to find. End footnote. Dilute sulfuric acid by slowly adding it to 3 1/3 times its weight in water, put iron filings in a barrel, and pour your diluted acid on top of those iron filings in a 2-to-1 ratio by weight, meaning 2 kilograms of acid gets poured on top of 1 kilogram of iron. This will react to give you your hydrogen. You can then pass it through a second barrel filled with slaked lime, which you can make in Appendix C4, to remove any acid carried over with the gas, which you'll want to do because otherwise the gas you're producing could eat through your balloon, historically, rarely a good thing. The sulfuric acid will exhaust itself before the iron does, so you can drain out the used up acid from the first barrel and refill it with more until there's no more iron left to react. Your hydrogen production apparatus will look like this. And here we have figure 46, an apparatus for the production of hydrogen. We have in one barrel, iron filings at the bottom, dilute sulfuric acid on top, and a pipe leading out from the top of that barrel to the bottom of a second barrel, filled with slaked lime. At the top, a tube lets the hydrogen gas out. Around 400 kilograms of iron and 800 kilograms of acid will produce about 140 cubic meters of hydrogen, and 10 cubic meters of hydrogen is enough to lift around 10.7 kilograms, depending on the day's air pressure, temperature, and humidity. Now, before you rush out to start mixing sulfuric acid and iron together, keep in mind, hydrogen is an extremely flammable, violently explosive gas. The world was horribly reminded of this on May 6, 1937 CE, when a hydrogen-filled aircraft named Hindenburg burst into flames and fell to the ground while attempting to dock with a mooring mast in a disaster so ghastly that it ended the entire era of hydrogen airship travel. The culprit was a single spark of static electricity. End note, no one is 100% certain about this, actually. Most researchers believe that a static spark was the initial cause that led to fire, but other theories have involved causes including engine backfire, sabotage, or lightning. End note. At this point, you may be thinking, wow, why didn't they just use helium instead? That's definitely what I would have used. And yes, while helium doesn't explode, react, and is the next lightest gas, with about 88% of the lifting power of hydrogen, it is much, much harder to come by. The only natural source of helium on Earth is produced through the extremely slow radioactive decay of heavy elements like uranium. And even when that happens, any helium that isn't trapped deep underground escapes into the atmosphere, where it's so light that it eventually ends up lost in space. Helium is an almost entirely non-renewable resource. So if you want inexpensive and efficient lighter-than-air flight, your only option in the short term is to use hydrogen and be very, 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 very careful. Footnote. In the 1960s CE, the United States actually started stockpiling helium underground as part of a national helium reserve, and by 1995 CE, 1 billion cubic meters of gas were being stored. However, in the next year, the government decided to begin phasing out the reserve to save money, selling the stored gases to industry. There are a few ways to produce helium without relying on natural reserves: hydrogen fusion, proton bombardment of lithium in a particle accelerator, or through lunar mining missions, But these are all, it's fair to say, slightly more expensive alternatives. End footnote. There is, however, one more alternative, inducing things heavier than air to fly. While inventing lighter-than-air flight is pretty trivial, the basics of heavier-than-air flight are sadly a lot more complicated than saying, just fill a bag with hot air or other light gas, you're done, see ya. To make matters worse, a fully detailed explanation of aerodynamics would require much more space than we have available, and this probably won't be read unless there's a catastrophic failure in your FC-3000 rental market time machine, and seriously, how likely is that going to be? Repair guide. But even the basics of how heavier-than-air flight works will put your civilization thousands and thousands of years ahead of everyone else throughout history. And with that head start, you can do what we did in our own history. Build planes, run experiments, and use science to figure out what works. You'll save a lot of time and broken limbs and money and human lives by first building a wind tunnel, which is just a large tube you blow air through, but which still took humans until 1871 CE to come up with. It's a simple invention, but it flips the script by letting you study flight by moving air over a stationary wing, usually a model, rather than trying to study a moving wing as it tears through the atmosphere, usually by flying an experimental plane and kind of just seeing what happens. Attach strings to see how air flows around an aircraft, or introduce smoke to follow the movements of air directly. You can measure the aerodynamic forces on the plane itself by mounting it on a balance scale, which, if you haven't invented it yet, is simply a beam mounted on top of a triangle with platters hanging off each side. When weights on both sides of the beam are equal, the beam is balanced. Build your wind tunnel balance scale with one arm entering the side of the wind tunnel to hold the plane, and the other side outside the wind tunnel, holding weights equal to the resting weight of the plane. As the wing generates lift in the air tunnel, the apparent weight of the plane changes, and you'll be able to quantify the lift it's generating. Footnote. Unfortunately, aerodynamic forces don't scale perfectly, which means a model plane won't fly in the exact same way a full-size plane will. You'll still need to do some experiments, but you'll have the advantage of knowing how wings work and how changes to their shape affects their performance. And you'll save yourself the hundreds of years we wasted on planes that flap their wings like birds, planes that flap their wings like bats, screws that point upward to burrow through the air itself, and so on. End footnote. A wing, in cross-section, looks like this. And here we have figure 47, a wing in cross-section. It's an elongated teardrop shape with airflow passing both above and below the wing. The airflow going above the wing is slightly faster than the airflow beneath the wing. Wings work through locally changing air pressure by exploiting the fact, which you should now credit yourself with discovering, that an object moving through a gas will remain in contact with the gas at all points and all times. Footnote, this also holds in fluids too. Now you've discovered two natural laws in as many sentences. Hey, good thing you read this footnote. End footnote. The wing splits the air, causing the air traveling over the top to be curved and pulled down to match the shape of the wing. This forces the air to occupy a larger volume, which reduces its pressure. In contrast, the air traveling underneath the wing is pushed into a smaller area of space, which increases air pressure there. This change in pressure is what generates an upward force called lift. Wings generate lift in a second way too, and it's by exploiting the same equal and opposite reaction law you use to invent propellers in section 10.12.5, boats. Air passing both over and under the wing is directed downward as it clears the wing, which in turn pushes the wing upward. You can deflect more air by tilting the wing more, and the more downward force the wing creates, the more it generates lift. Up to a certain point, at which the air no longer flows smoothly along the wing, causing turbulence in the air, a huge reduction in lift, and a stalled and soon falling aircraft. Of course, to generate that lift, you need to thrust your wings through the air. This can be done by jets or rockets, but most planes, and we imagine most time travelers, will use propellers instead, which are really just a set of tiny rotating wings that move the plane forward instead of up. Footnote. Early aircraft designers weren't sure which worked better, propellers at the back of the wing to push it, or propellers at the front to pull it. Front works best. Propellers behind wings are less efficient due to pushing through air that's already been disturbed by having a plane fly through it. Actually, early aircraft designers weren't sure about a lot of things, so if you aren't either, don't worry. For decades, every single person who flew managed to do so without having a correct understanding of how and why their planes really worked. End footnote. By introducing a slight twisting to the shape of your propeller, you'll make the entire propeller more efficient. In fact, slight changes to the shape of wings, whether used in a propeller or not, can have large effects, and that's one property you're going to exploit when building your plane. Here's what a simple plane looks like, and it's a design you'll want to copy. Here we have Figure 48, the parts of a plane. It's a standard plane design with a propeller at the front, a long cylindrical body, and two wings, larger ones at the front and smaller ones at the back. On the front, larger wings, we have left flaps and right flaps on the left and right-hand side of the plane, and left ailerons and right ailerons. On the back wing, we have a left elevator and right elevator. At the very back of the plane, there's a vertical fin called a vertical stabilizer that has a rudder on the back. The tail wing helps stabilize the plane when it's flying, and the flaps at the trailing edge there, called elevators, will move the rear of the plane up or down, which lets you control the up-down angle of the plane. The rudder moves left and right, which moves the nose of the plane left and right. The ailerons at the front are used to roll the plane over, lift one side up and lower the other side down, and the plane will begin to roll. Besides sweet tricks, these help you stabilize the plane and keep it flat. Finally, the flaps function identically to the ailerons, but they are designed to go up or down at the same time, which allows you to adjust the amount of lift the wings generate simultaneously. You can lower your flaps to generate more lift, useful when easing a plane down to land at slower speeds, and raise them in order to accelerate to higher cruising speeds once airborne. Besides lift and thrust, the other two factors operating on a plane are weight, i.e. the gravity that pulls you down to Earth, and drag, which are any forces that oppose your thrust, like air resistance. And that's another area where heavier-than-air flight gets complicated. In theory, attach wings of sufficient size onto a thing capable of thrusting those wings forward, and you will fly. In practice, engines that generate the thrust required to get enough lift to make humans fly tend to themselves be heavy, which only makes the problem more difficult. Internal combustion engines have a better power-to-weight ratio, but steam-powered aircraft have been briefly but successfully flown in the past. The first manned, heavier-than-air powered flight was in 1874 CE with a steam-powered aircraft that predated the Wright brothers by almost 30 years. Footnote. The Wright brothers produced the first manned, heavier-than-air, self-powered flight. The 1874 CE machine was steam-powered, but could fly only after ramping off a ski jump and then gliding to the ground. The steam engine on board was insufficient to sustain flight. Speaking of the Wrights, once they'd invented and patented airplanes, they stopped innovating and spent most of their time suing not just their competitors, but even individual pilots who dared to fly non-Wright aircraft. These lawsuits had a ruinous effect on American aviation. By January 1912, in France, where the Wrights also had a patent, but where its enforcement had been stayed repeatedly, more than 800 aviators were making flights each day, compared to only 90 in the United States. The lawsuits ended only in 1917 CE, when the U.S. government legally forced airplane manufacturers to share their patents, but the damage was done. When the United States entered World War I in that same year, it was with French-built airplanes. All American aircraft were deemed unacceptably inferior. All of this is to say, if you do decide to invent heavier-than-air flight, maybe try to be a bit more chill about it. End footnote. But before you begin the hard work of attaching engines to planes, experiment with gliders first. Planes without engines that are launched from high places. These are the training wheels of airplanes, and while the technical prerequisites for heavier-than-air powered flight are steep, all you need for gliding is some wood, some fabric, and some know-how, which we've already provided. Temporal experiments have been performed in which a functional wooden glider was introduced to Europe in 1000 CE with no other supporting technologies. This still doesn't produce powered flight until around the Industrial Revolution in 1760 CE, but it does reliably produce aircraft carriers, complete with crossbow-style catapults to launch them into the sky, by the Renaissance of the early 1400s. Endnote. Obviously, this claim is as impossible for me to verify as it is tantalizing to imagine, but it is true that gliders were used to explore the theory and practice behind powered flight and are an almost necessary first step towards powered aircraft. And endnote. Your civilization will probably want to start with hot air balloons right away, and then begin experimentation with either airships or heavier-than-air flight, but it's entirely up to you. You didn't travel back in time for some book to tell you not to cover yourself in chicken feathers just to see what happens, and we respect your choices. 10.13